You're listening to Commute, the podcast. Congratulations, you'll be smarter when you get there.
What up? Welcome into Commute, the podcast. I'm Dave.
And I'm Jay.
And we are about to take you on a deep dive on three topics that we find interesting, and we're betting that you might just find them interesting too. We can promise you this, you'll be smarter when you get there. On this edition of Commute,
our last name can tell a story of where we come from and who we are. But imagine a world in which we all had the same one. Well, that vision may be more of a reality in the future in Japan.
Typically, if something is good, it takes a little time. But not always. Sometimes inspiration just hits you. This week, some super popular songs that were all written in less than 30 minutes.
He's been part cautionary tale and part punchline because of his mere 30 days as president of the United States. But did William Henry Harrison get a bad rap?
All of that on this edition of Commute. Let's go.
So Dave, both you and I have, I guess, unique last names. They're not super common. It's not like Smith or something like that. And my last name being Sisson, what I remember realizing in elementary school whenever the kids started calling me Sissy Sisson, that maybe it, you know, wasn't something loved
not
then.
Bad.
I like it, you know, as I've grown up with it, obviously. But we all go through hurdles having our last names, I think, in spots. You have a unique last name. Have you liked it? Have you gone through a trial period with it like I did? Like, what's the experience of being a Traub been like for you?
Yeah, when I was young, I hated it, to be honest with you. Like, I just could not stand my last name. I was always last, so you're in line. It's typically alphabetical order. I'm at the end. People are constantly misspelling it. My all-star baseball shirt, which was like, that's cool. You're 12 years old. You can't wait to get this shirt. It's got every player's name on the back. Mine was spelled Travce, Travce, which is way off. But as I've gotten older, I really like it because it's unique. It's a lot easier to be Dave Traub than like Dave Smith because there's a million Dave Smiths. Now, every once in a while, though, it rears its ugly head. So I'm coaching T-ball this year. And last week was opening day for the T-ball league. And so as part of the opening day ceremony, you as the head coach and your team come out on the field and they announce your names. It's like everyone's clapping and cheering, and it's this really cool thing for the kids. So, you know, I'm excited. The kids are loving it. We come out on the field and the Cubs are coached by Dave Traub. Like, didn't ask me, didn't take the time to maybe think this guy's last name's a little, you know, different. Should we see how it's phonetically spelled out? No, didn't even ask.
I mean, it doesn't even make like sense in English to say it Traub. I don't know why.
That
would be the first reaction.
And that's all anybody wanted to talk about, too, afterwards. Like, Traub!
I've struggled my whole life because my first name is Jay and my last name is Sisson. And when you say it all together, it sounds like Jason. And so I've struggled my whole life of people just thinking that my name is Jason.
Interesting quick little factoid. When I was young, I actually wanted my name to be Jason.
So. Did you like walk around and tell kids that your name was Jason?
I may have.
Yeah, you did for probably, I would imagine, just tried it out. You just tried it on like a shirt. You
know? My name's Jason Jones, kids.
Well, Dave, there actually is a study out there led by Hiroshi Yoshida, a professor of economics at Tohoku University in Japan, that projects that at current rates, if current policies in Japan hold true, that every single Japanese person will have the same surname in about 500 years. Now, that particular surname is Sato, meaning that by specifically 2531, every single Japanese person will be known as Sato-san. And to explain this, well, we have to dive a little into what happens to someone when they get married in Japan and how that is uniquely different than everywhere else in the world. This study, by the way, was published on April 1st, which led most of social media to assume it was an April Fool's Day prank, but it is very much not. Now, Dave, Sato is already the most common surname in Japan and accounts for 1.5% of the total population, with Suzuki as a close second. According to Yoshida, the proportion of Japanese named Sato increased 1.0083 times from 2022 to 2023. Now, assuming that rate stays constant, around half of the Japanese population will have that name by 2445, and then 100% by 2531. Now, this study's projections only work, though, if current policy in Japan on surnames, which actually dates back to the 1800s, remains the same. Currently, Japan is the only nation in the world that requires married spouses to use the same surname. And while couples do get to choose which surname to follow, in 95% of cases, it is the wife who changes her surname. And Dave, there actually is quite a deal of pressure on the Japanese government to try to change this law, which many, especially younger and more progressive Japanese citizens, see as outdated. Others argue that it destroys family and regional heritage, as names are wiped out forever on family trees, one marriage at a time. Proposals have been pushed for that would give Japanese citizens more flexibility in choosing to maintain their family surname even through marriage. And while some small steps have been taken, such as allowing maiden names on passports and driver's licenses, Yoshida's study highlights something here in a country as small as Japan. I mean, there are only 125 million total people living there. Even though we're talking about 500 years in the future, groups calling for this sort of change are hoping a study like this can give them some ammunition to get some momentum towards changing this policy. But Dave, there are critics on the other side as well, people who maintain that changing the law would undermine family unity and cause confusion among children, according to The Guardian. But all in all, it's a fascinating look at how the modern world intersects with outdated policy and what it can mean for the future, even if it's the very distant future.
All right, so I've got a list of the top 100 last names in the U.S. The top 10 is pretty interesting. So you've got number one, far and away, Smith.
Right. Makes sense.
Number two, Johnson. Number three, Williams. I mean, it kind of goes in the way that you think it would.
It's kind of chalk so far.
I'll tell you what, though. I'll tell you what. Davis sneaks in there at number eight.
I grew up in a town with a lot of people with last name Davis, so that one's not too surprising to me.
I'll tell you another one that sneaks in there. Wilson sneaking in there at 14 in the top 20.
Yeah, I don't know a lot of Wilsons now that I think about it.
I'll tell you the two Wilsons that come to mind first for me would be Wilson. I think his name might be Wilson Wilson. He's the neighbor in Home Alone. Not Home Alone, Home Improvement, the Tim Allen show. And then there's Wilson the volleyball from Castaway.
Yeah, not a person, but...
Jay, a little known fact about you and me is that we are actually in a Christmas band together. It's a silly yet super fun thing that I started with my childhood best friend back in 2006, I think it was, something like that. At some point, we added you into the mix. I think that was maybe 2009, 2010.
Sounds about
right. A few other people have joined since. And we've been writing original Christmas music together almost every year since. And it's actually super fun to do.
Well, something about us both is that we commit to the bit. You know, like if the bit is happening, we're committed to the joke. And we will not give up on the joke. And so we started writing Christmas songs as a joke. But then in order to commit to the bit, we had to like actually, because we actually play instruments, we're actually good at them. So we actually started writing like real Christmas songs with like lore and like chord structure and like actually like doing it in a professional sense. And that furthers the joke. Then we decided to have a live show in which we wrote a whole script around it and performed it. So again, further committing to the bit.
And I'll tell you what, man, we have written a ton of hits, including Fat Boy Christmas Blues, which is a song about Mrs. Claus leaving Santa. Reservation, Table for One. It's about making a Christmas dinner reservation for yourself. We've got Only Daddy, a song about a boy hoping his dad will come home for Christmas and hang up the star instead of go to the bar. And I should probably mention, for some reason, most of these songs take a depressingly dark turn.
But that's part of the joke.
When they come out. They're funny, though. Yeah, trust me, they're funny. But, Jay, perhaps our best song, at least in terms of catchiness, is called No Pride Yuletide, a song we wrote in about 10 minutes. And if you've ever tried to write a song, or really anything creative, you know that it's pretty atypical for the creative process to happen that quickly. For every 10-minute song, there are dozens that took days to write, if not weeks. So, Jay, this week, we're going to look at some of the most successful songs in history that went the way of No Pride Yuletide. Today, we're looking at some of the most successful songs that were written in 30 minutes or less. Jay, we start in 1986, a song made popular in recent times by Travis Kelce. the tight end for the Kansas City Chiefs and boyfriend to Taylor Swift. The Beastie Boys released their famous song in 1986, You've Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party. Written to make fun of frat boys and their party lifestyles, it was ironically embraced by both frat boys and non-frat boys, and it helped propel the band to stardom. Mike D from the band told Penthouse magazine that the song was not only written in 5 minutes, but it was written on a napkin. You don't have to be a fan of the band Guns N' Roses to know the song Sweet Child of Mine. Featured in commercials, movies, and on the popular video game Rock Band, band member Axl Rose told Hit Parader magazine that he heard band member Slash messing around with some guitar riffs, and the lyrics just kind of came to him. It was written in about 5 minutes, the band told Hit Parader. It was one of those songs that only has three chords. You know, that guitar lick that Slash does at the beginning? Well, it was kind of a joke because we thought, like, what is this song even going to be? It'll be nothing. Maybe we'll just make it filler on the record. And now it's probably their most famous song. In 1958, the legendary Ray Charles and his band were playing a gig in Pittsburgh. Before the gig was supposed to end, Charles realized he had played his entire catalog. Worried that he'd lose the paycheck if he didn't fill the full time slot that they'd been scheduled for, he had about 15 minutes left, by the way, he improvised a song that would become known as What I Say, one of his most beloved hits. Jay, music producer The Dream has hit gold twice and very quickly. In 2008, he walked into a recording studio and reportedly joked that he was going to write the next big single for superstar Beyonce. And Jay, as it would turn out, he did. In 17 minutes, which seems suspiciously specific, by the way, he had produced the lyrics to the number one song from that year's charts, Single Ladies. And just a year prior, in 2007, he had done the same thing for pop star Rihanna. According to media outlet Dazed, The Dream walked into the studio, heard a beat, and then just started singing. I maybe had to go back and change like four words, he would say. But the version you hear today is almost exactly as it came out, her song Umbrella. Jay, David Bowie, Ed Sheeran, Lorde, even Taylor Swift, all of them have reportedly at least struck gold once in their careers by quickly pinning an eventual hit in less than 30 minutes. But it's perhaps Dolly Parton that takes the cake. Jay, Dolly has told the story multiple times through the years, but one night in 1972, she sat down to write what would quickly become her most famous song, I Will Always Love You. But what did she do almost immediately after finishing that song, you ask? She kept writing. And a few minutes later, she had written another song, Jolene.
Of course. It's kind of infuriating when it happens to you, too, because like you work on a song that's okay, and it takes you like 4 weeks or something, and then you do one that you're like, this is the best thing I've ever written in my life, and it just like happened spontaneously.
It's always maddening too when you find out that people like Taylor Swift wrote some of their most famous songs when they were like 13 or 14. Because man, the stuff I was writing when I was 13 or 14,
I mean, she had help. Like, she wasn't, you know what I mean, like, she wasn't like sitting up there writing it and then just putting it out as is.
Just because you and I were writing songs like, I'm gonna go to my room, I hate you, like teenage angst, that doesn't mean everybody was doing that.
So we're going to wrap up today by talking about U.S. presidents, specifically one U.S. president, our shortest serving U.S. president. And before we get started, we've talked about various presidents on this show before, but do you have a favorite president that you learned about in school, Dave? Like, where are you at with your knowledge of our executive branch?
Favorite president? Maybe by name.
You're gonna say my like favorite Miller president Fillmore by name.
No, Cleveland. Grover Cleveland. That's an incredible name.
Yeah, Grover Cleveland. I mean, he got in there twice, too. I mean, so pretty impressive stuff.
Okay, there you go. You don't want to pick like an actual good president. You want to pick a random one.
Out of the 46, like how many you think you got in you? Like if you just had to sit down and name
them. How many could I name?
Yeah. I think you could get 30. Like half.
I think I could get 30.
Yeah, I mean, you got like your Roosevelts and Bushes and Adams. Like, yeah, you get twofers, you know.
You could kind of stumble into at least.
But then 30. You get in, and there's like the Franklin Pierces and the James Buchanans and people like that that you know you just don't really
never heard
about.
Of them. No idea.
Well, we're going to be talking about William Henry Harrison, and William Henry Harrison. If you ever learned about him in school and it stuck, I'm surprised because he is definitely one of the least known presidents in U.S. history. Due to being the shortest serving president in U.S. history at only literally 32 days. In fact, if you remember him at all, it's probably for that singular reason, because that short stint definitely makes him one of the most unique presidents in U.S. history. And over the years, people have had fun pointing this out. The animated show The Simpsons had an episode that featured a song about the tale of our shortest serving president, and an episode of the popular NBC show Parks and Recreation featured an episode in which the characters spent the entire runtime arguing over whether or not Harrison was lame for dying so early into his presidency. But Harrison's rise to the presidency itself was anything but lame. He had carved out a career for himself early and was known as a military hero who led his troops to victory against the Native American Confederacy in 1811 at the Battle of Tippecanoe, and then took Detroit back from the British and won the Battle of Thames, both during the War of 1812. Harrison then became a senator for the state of Ohio and then won the presidency from an incumbent president, Martin Van Buren, in 1840. When this happened, he was actually 67, and that made him the oldest president to ever be elected, a record that would hold all the way until 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected at 69 years old. But what you may remember Harrison most for is what has traditionally been seen as the event that led to his quick exit from the presidency, his inauguration day. On this day, the weather in Washington, D.C. was very cold and rainy, and Harrison stood in front of the crowd without an overcoat, a hat, or gloves, and delivered an 8,445-word speech that lasted almost 2 hours. In 3 weeks, Harrison developed a cold and died from what doctors thought was pneumonia, which they concluded he sustained from standing in the cold too long during his inauguration speech. So from that moment on, the story was written on Harrison, and it has been both a cautionary tale and a punchline, depending on who you ask. But in recent years, historians and doctors both have begun asking questions surrounding Harrison's death and speculating on what actually caused it. Harrison's own doctor, in fact, was skeptical that it was pneumonia that actually caused his death, writing that he believed the cause may have been something more complicated, and doctors at the time took the simple way out in explaining his death the way that they did. In 2014, a writer, Jane McHugh, and a doctor of medicine at the University of Maryland, Philip Makowiak, reviewed the evidence through a lens of modern medicine and actually came up with a new diagnosis, enteric fever, which is more commonly known as typhoid. Now, Dave, context here is also very important. Before 1850, Washington, D.C. sewage was dumped into a marsh that was just 7 blocks upstream from the White House's water supply. McHugh and Makowiak speculated that because of this, Harrison may have been exposed to bacteria that could have caused this fever. Harrison had a history of bad indigestion already, and exposure to this type of bacteria would have made him more susceptible. Also, medical records show that doctors treating Harrison gave him opium and enemas, both of which would have caused more harm than good to someone in his condition. Also, what makes this more interesting is the fact that Harrison was not the only president to have severe gastrointestinal issues while occupying the White House. Following presidents, James K. Polk and Zachary Taylor also suffered from pretty bad gastroenteritis while in the White House, which McHugh and Makowiak theorized was the same thing affecting Harrison. And while Polk recovered, Taylor died in office of his illness too, 10 years after the death of Harrison. And while giving a 2-hour speech in the cold wasn't necessarily a great decision, there is some evidence out there that it didn't necessarily lead to the shortest presidency in U.S. history.
I really thought he died on the toilet. So it sounds like I wasn't that far off.
I don't know where you got that. I mean,
I don't either.
The closest I can get is William Howard Taft, who got stuck in a bathtub, but he didn't die.
That's pretty
close. So, like, I don't, you know, that's. Or Jurassic Park, where he got eaten off a toilet.
You know, I bet you that's what it is. I seriously think that's what it is. So he was president for 31 days. What? That's a short. That's a short job.
Pretty short.
What's your shortest job ever?
All the jobs that I had, I worked for more like for years. So I didn't have a Radio Shack experience like you.
I was going to say. No, it's probably when you were at Old Navy and you got blacklisted.
But I still worked there for a while.
You said you weren't going to quit, and you did. yeah, mine was Radio Shack. I worked at Radio Shack for 4 hours.
So you're the William Henry Harrison of Radio Shack.
I am. They call me that. I should have framed it. I remember when I got the check in the mail from my four-hour shift. You want to guess how much it was after taxes?
I can't believe they even sent you a check.
Well, they have to legally.
I guess they have to legally.
Take a guess at how much it was after taxes.
I mean, $4 back then, you were probably making, what, like $7 an hour or something? So, I mean, probably like $18 or something.
It was like $19.70.
Hey, don't spend it all in one place.
I remember walking in. And everybody that worked, I was in high school, everybody that worked there was smoking out front. There were three other people. And they put me in the back to do training. And the second I sat down, I thought, I'm out of here at lunch. And that's it. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, subscribe, and review Commute on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast network. We're on social. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can always say what up at our website, commutethepodcast.com. Music for Commute is provided by my main man, Jason Sammons. For Jay Sisson, I'm Dave Traub. We'll see you next week.
3, 2, 1. Once, gosh, keep messing that up. All right, 3, 2, 1. Oh, gosh. All right. 3, 2, 1.
You all right over there?
Yeah, no, I'm good. I just keep hitting these words. And 3, 2, 1. Philip Makowak? Philip Mako. Gosh, man. Macau. All right. I got it. All right. 3, 2, 1. While in the White House, which McHugh and Makowak... Gosh, sorry. This guy's name is killing me.